Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to Mazda's focus to ensure every element of a car is designed around the driver. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. Around the country, people are surging to the polls. The same is true in North Carolina. More than 2 million people have already participated in early voting, and that number may be closer to 3 million before Election Day, which is next week. We've also set records here for mail-in ballots. But the surge in voter participation may be matched by a surge in legal activity before Election Day in challenges to the voting process around the nation. In fact, 2020 might go down as the most litigated election in our history. Nearly 300 lawsuits have been filed, including several here in North Carolina over election changes that were prompted by the pandemic. 20 years after the Supreme Court's Bush v. Gore decision ended the prolonged 2000 election, might the High Court become involved in the outcome of this year's contest? We're going to take a deep dive into that this hour, and we begin with a look at what's been happening in the Tar Heel State with Jordan Wilkie, a Report for America core member who is the lead contributing reporter covering election integrity, open government, and civil liberties with Carolina Public Press. Jordan, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it. Good morning.
Glad to be here.
We'll be joined by others later in the hour. Here in North Carolina, we have been going back and forth on the status of absentee mail-in ballots and whether ballots with errors can be fixed, how they can be fixed, how long ballots can be accepted after Election Day, and it goes on and on and on. How unusual are these legal questions that are being raised here in North Carolina or elsewhere, for that matter, during elections? Are they unusual? Are they becoming more usual, more the norm than in prior years?
I mean, the questions that we're facing this year, North Carolina has never faced before. This year, we have 778,000 absentee by mail ballots that have already been accepted. We're expecting at least 200,000 more to be accepted by the time it's all said and done. And this is many times over what was accepted in 2016. In 2016, we had 5% of our total ballots cast were absentee by mail. Registered Republicans had a plurality in the number of in using that method. And so this year, it's just a completely different game with different levels of attention on absentee by mail that, North Carolina has never seen before and many states around the country have never seen before.
Is that because of the sheer number of them? Because surely we've had mistakes with mail-in ballots before, and we've had errors and omissions on mail-in ballots before, and there have been no lawsuits. How did they handle all of that in the past?
Right. The intention was just not as significant because the numbers weren't as significant. I think there was also a less cantankerous political environment, though it's been, pretty aggressive for several years. I mean, a lot of listeners will remember that in 2018, those absentee by mail ballots that were used in Bladen and North Carolina 9th Congressional District to conduct one of the few proven election fraud schemes that this country is really seeing. Usually those are a little more than hot air, but in North Carolina, we made it real. And since then, we changed the laws around how you can track, how you can see, how the public can see who's requested an absentee by mail ballot. And that is supposed to prevent, and as far as we can tell, has prevented absentee by mail fraud. But ever since then, this has been a pretty hot button issue.
So there are four cases that have attracted the most attention here in North Carolina: Democracy NC versus the State Board of Elections, Alliance for Retired Americans versus North Carolina, and Moore versus Sercosta plus Wise versus the State Board of Elections. You have written about all of these. Is there a dime's worth of difference among all of these?
Yes. So Democracy NC, I'll try to keep it at a dime's worth. Democracy NC versus State Board of Elections was filed back over the summer. In June, the state legislature, knew that coronavirus was going to change our elections, and they decided to make some changes to how we conducted our election administration, especially around absentee by mail ballots. And Democracy NC thought that apologies for that, Siren Democracy NC thought that that was not significant enough. So they filed a very wide-ranging lawsuit. Democracy NC is a voter rights advocate group. And the federal judge in that case denied the majority of their claims, but said in one specific instance, North Carolina needs some intervention. And that is that if someone makes a mistake on their ballot, there needs to be some method for notifying the voter and fixing that mistake, as long as it's, you know, relatively insignificant, you know, put their name on the wrong line,
right.
Forgot their address, something like that.
You have written that the outcomes of all of these suits could affect at most 1 to 2% of the total vote cast. But both parties are fighting hard. I know that we're a swing state, but could victories in these suits make that much of a difference in the outcome?
Yeah, and I will say that 1 to 2% is really generous. I mean, I would be, at this point, that doesn't even look possible. I mean, we are expecting maybe 200,000 more absentee by mail ballots to be submitted. We have another week before their, before Election Day. And then after that, there's another part here that's under contention of, will we extend the absentee by mail acceptance deadline? If they're mailed before Election Day, then they can be received until the Friday after Election Day. Right. But under the new rules, due to some of the litigation, they can be received until November 12th. And there's a fight about that extra 6-day window that's, you know, in front of the state Supreme Court and the, you know, the U.S. Supreme Court right now. And the legal arguments that each side are making to get to those cases have pretty significant potential implications for elections down the line. But for this election, it's really a very extremely small margin of votes. It seems to me that if this election is you know won by any significant margin at all, these lawsuits won't have any practical impact for this election.
Given that this is a presidential election year with record turnout, and it's only going to be 1 to 2% of the vote cast in with these potential problems with ballots that were these lawsuits address, and that's being generous, why would the impact of the outcome of these suits be greater in future elections than it is right now?
Right. Well, one of the things that happened is a group sued in North Carolina State Court, and the State Board of Elections settled the lawsuit, so it didn't give them everything they wanted, but settled parts of it, and right. parts of that settlement changed some of the state law that was on the books. And now there's a question of who has the authority in what situation to change state law. Is it exclusively the legislature, or can executive agencies that the legislature has given authority to also do that in certain circumstances? So that case, that question is in front of the state Supreme Court and the federal Supreme Court. Now, it gets more significant, but unfortunately also more complicated, because then you have a question of whose authority really weighs in here. Can the federal courts step in and make jurisdictional claims on things that are in front of a state Supreme Court? Typically, that hasn't happened, but based on a very strict reading of the Constitution, it could be argued that when the constitutional gives authority, when the Constitution gives authority to state legislatures to make state law regarding elections, it means, you know, very literally only state legislatures, not other branches of the state government, which is how it's been interpreted to date. So the consequence of that, to wrap this up, the consequence of that is if that argument wins, which so far it is in the strict minority, if that argument wins in front of the states, in front of the federal U.S. Supreme Court, then it basically means that elections with federal races down the line can't have the rules changed or intervened by states, state courts or state executive branches. And the federal courts would be the place that you would go to make any changes if you thought there was an issue. And that would be a complete re-scrambling of what has existed to date, with the small exception of Bush v. Gore, where the U.S. Supreme Court came in and made a different ruling than the state Supreme Court. That was supposed to be limited. This would be a wider application of that.
So last week, a federal appeals court decided not to block a state court of appeals decision that mail-in ballots in North Carolina can be accepted until November the 12th if they are postmarked on or before Election Day. What's the upshot of that decision?
The upshot is that voters have a little more peace of mind when they submit their absentee by mail ballot. USPS has said it, you know, will take 2 to 5 days to deliver first class mail, which is what election mail is. It sometimes has taken a little bit longer than that. So we wouldn't expect to see a whole lot of absentee by mail ballots showing up after the deadline that existed until recently, which was Friday, November 6th. But it just means that potentially, if this ruling is held up, that up to a couple thousand, maybe more ballots will be counted instead of being considered after deadline.
So this decision provides guidance on how so-called deficient ballots can be cured or fixed. And I'm just curious as to how they did it prior to this decision. There were probably always missing signatures or misplaced signatures or witness signatures not available or whatever it may be. How did they handle it prior to this?
Right. I mean, this has been a longstanding issue in North Carolina and in states all around the country. The very few states that do all absentee by mail ballot have a pretty good grasp on this. But the rest of us, this is our first go round. So the Democracy NC case that was filed over the summer, one of the things they complained about is that we didn't have a process for curing this. And North Carolina never before had a process for curing this. The judge in that case said that's a due process violation. You can't just out of hand deny someone's vote because there was a potentially insignificant error here. And so North Carolina created a process where if you have some sort of mistake on your ballot, the county board of elections will contact you and say, would you like to cure this? And if you do, then there's a letter that you sign that says, yes, this is indeed my ballot. Yes, I made a mistake, but I am the one who voted it. Okay. It's a way of saying, you know, this ballot wasn't fraudulent. The error isn't evidence of fraud. Yes, indeed, this is mine. And then there was a fight over the extent of what could be cured. And so that went on for a couple months, but that's now settled.
There's another case that the Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals made a decision about, and it's the one case that is still alive. They decided not to block an extension to the deadline when the absentee ballots can be accepted, but at the same time, dissenting judges on the court encouraged the losing party to appeal to the U.S. Supreme Court, quote, immediately, not tomorrow, not the next day, now. Pretty strong words, and legislative leaders promised to do just that. The U.S. Supreme Court just ruled on a similar case in Pennsylvania, which allowed election officials there to count mail-in ballots up to 3 days after the election. How might that impact this case in 60 seconds, more or less?
I am not a U.S. Supreme Court scholar, so I'm not sure. What I can tell you is that they did appeal that case. It is in front of the Supreme Court. Judge Roberts directed the Supreme Court per the docket for the other judges to have some decisions in over the weekend. And so we are expecting to see the consequence of their thinking early this week, but definitely before Judge Barrett is seated.
Where's the betting money going on how they're going to come down on this?
I'm not a betting man. There are too many options, and this is outside my realm of expertise. I can tell you what has happened, but I can't look into the future for you.
Jordan Wilkie is the lead reporter for Report for America and Carolina Public Press on open government, civil liberties, and election integrity. And he joins us from Durham this morning. Thank you for being here. I appreciate it.
Absolutely.
And we come back, we're going to talk to a couple of legal scholars about more of these court cases here and around the country and what they mean for this election and those going forward in a moment at Charlotte Talks. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, dedicated to those who believe a car should stir one's emotions and deliver a heightened state of driving. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We continue looking at the potential impact of this election on this election of legal challenges to the process, and we're going to broaden out the discussion now to a national level with Joshua Douglas, professor of law at the University of Kentucky College of Law and author of Vote for Us, How to Take Back Our Elections and Change the future of voting. I know he's a serious scholar because he is wearing a Hamilton hoodie this morning.
That's right. Thanks for having me on. And anything when we talk about elections and constitutional law and can bring in a Broadway musical is a good morning for me.
Thanks for being here. I appreciate it. And Edward Foley is also here. He is the Ohio State University Moritz College of Law Chair in Constitutional Law and Director of Election Law at Moritz and the author of Ballot Battles, The History of Disputed Elections in the United States. Thanks for being here as well. Welcome.
Great to be with both of you today.
And the two of you have written a legal textbook. What's the book?
Well, it's a book for students who take election law, and it's got a boring title, Election Law and Litigation, but it covers the gamut from redistricting all the way to Bush versus Gore and things like that.
Now, I'm going to call you Ned because you've given me permission to do that. Can I call you Josh?
Please do.
Okay.
And Ned, I have to say, is a mentor of mine and pretty much the person to talk to about election law in this country. So you've done a great job booking this morning, and it's a pleasure to be with both of you.
I had no control over that. Great producers. So let me begin with you, Ned, and we'll put you to the test here. You have looked at disputed elections through history, where courts have intervened, impacting about 1% of the vote, as they have in this state. Could that lead to further disputes locally or nationally if this election is close? In other words, no matter what they decide before the election, there's more to come, right?
Sure, it could happen, theoretically. I mean, it has to be close, right? I mean, what Bush versus Gore taught us back in 2000 is a statewide margin of 537 votes is close enough to litigate. As Josh will confirm, in our business, we compare two numbers. The margin of victory, or the reported margin of victory starting on election night in preliminary returns. And then we compare that to what we think is the margin of litigation. You know, how much room is there to fight over ballots to try to change the result? It could happen in a presidential race like Florida 2000. It could happen in a U.S. Senate race like in Minnesota in 2008, which was when Al Franken, the comedian, as a challenger, won a seat to the U.S. Senate in another extraordinarily close race. So these are rare. It happens when they're really close.
I want to ask you some more about whether or not it really has to be close for these legal challenges to go forward, given the climate that we find ourselves in. I'll get to that a little bit later on. And by the way, Jordan Wilkie, our previous guest, just sent me a note saying that we passed 3 million votes over the weekend in North Carolina in terms of early voting. I had 2 million, but 3 million is where we are. So it may be even higher than that by Election Day. Josh, your book about taking back our elections is described as an encouraging assessment of current efforts to make our voting system more accessible, reliable, and effective. But when you look at tussles like the ones we're witnessing here in North Carolina, and which apparently impact minority voters disproportionately, not only here but around the country, when you witness moves in Texas to limit drop-off locations for ballots to one per county, which means that in Houston, which is the size of Rhode Island, there is one box. When you witness 11-hour-long lines to vote in the suburbs of Atlanta, how encouraged can you be about the future of our process?
I think what those stories tell us is that there's a dual storyline going on. You know, we've always had voter suppression, unfortunately, and we have voter suppression that typically harms minority voters the most and underrepresented voters the most. And we can't lose sight of that, and we need to push back against that. But at the same time, if we look at some other states that do this really well, we see high turnout and ease of voting. I mean, take Colorado, for example, which is a so-called purple state. And yet it has some of the best voting laws in the country, where people receive their ballots automatically and can fill them out at home and then drop them off at many drop boxes all over the state. You can vote in a vote center if you want to vote in person at a vote center anywhere in your county. So there's lots of eases of voting that some states and some localities have figured out. The problem is that not all states have figured them out. And particularly in states like you mentioned, like Texas, Alabama this year in particular has very restrictive voting laws. And we really see a dual storyline. You know, we think of red states and blue states, but we unfortunately have good voting states and bad voting states as well. And one of the points of my book is to demonstrate that we can adopt some of these what I call positive voting rights reforms, even in the so-called red states that have restrictive voting laws. Often it requires starting at the local level first and getting reforms and getting localities to change their voting rules that can then spread statewide. But we have a roadmap. We have a model for how to do this if we only look closely at some of the places that are already doing it well.
Do the good voting states, to use your words, and the bad voting states have something in common? Is there a common characteristic among those states?
Well, you know, I will say that many of the states that have more pro-voter policies tend to skew Democratic, but not all. So you look at Utah, for example, which automatically mails every voter a ballot. Arizona, which we typically think of as a so-called red state, although it looks like it may be more of a battleground in the presidential election this year, over 75% of the voters vote by mail well before the pandemic. So I think the common storyline is that you have places where they've tried out new things at the local level first, and you've had individual, what I call in the book, democracy champions, regular everyday Americans who have advocated for the localities to adopt various reforms. And then, you know, these things take time. You know, Colorado didn't go to universal vote by mail overnight. So it does take a little while to put these things into place. And one of the problems of trying to do this during the pandemic is it's required rapid changes by election officials. And sometimes, you know, those things can be bumpy as that happens. Now, you do have states like Texas that are just unwilling to change their rules,
right,
and are trying to restrict the vote. And so that's a separate storyline.
North Carolina has had its share so far this election season of lawsuits going back and forth, but we're not the only state going through this. Other states are too. And we have a president who has said that the only way he loses this election is if it is rigged, and he will not promise a peaceful transfer of power. So, Ned, that begs the question, is this now or is it likely to be the most litigated election in our nation's history?
Yeah, I think up to this point, it certainly has. I mean, our field has been putting some numerical benchmarks on the amount of litigation we've seen since Florida 2000, Bush versus Gore, and it's off the charts this year, just in terms of the number of lawsuits, over 300. You know, a lot of that is because of the pandemic and the need to make adjustments in the voting process. I think another large component of it is just the hyper partisanship and polarization of American politics right now that is creating a kind of arms race, if you will, in terms of litigation over the voting process. So that's all the skirmishing and the battles that are happening right now to affect the rules that are in place for casting ballots. We'll have to see after November 3rd how much litigation there is over the counting of the votes.
What does that say, all this litigation now, and particularly if the presidential race goes to the Supreme Court, what does that say, Josh, about the state of our democracy in 2020?
Well, I'm not sure what it says in terms of the state of our democracy. It says a lot of things, except for that probably the courts are playing too much of a role, you know, one way or the other. But I think if we dive into the judicial opinions, at least at the federal court level, it's really concerning with respect to the court's ability or willingness to protect the constitutional right to vote. If you just look at the federal cases, for example, I've found at least 25 cases that have been filed in federal courts that have then been appealed up to the federal courts of appeals or the Supreme Court. And the plaintiffs have won, that is, these cases where voting rights advocates have sued to change laws because states have been unwilling to do so themselves. And plaintiffs have found relief in only four of those cases, four of 25. And actually two of those four wins are where the state eventually did agree to change their rules. One of them being, of course, North Carolina, where the State Board of Elections changed their rules. The other one out of Rhode Island. And in at least 17 cases of those 25, the district courts, the federal trial courts, provided relief to the voting rights plaintiffs, saying that, yes, you know, running the election the current way the state wants to in the pandemic is going to violate the right to vote. And in those 17 cases, they were all reversed by the federal appeals courts that said, no, we just want to defer to the states. So I think we're seeing these appeals court judges and the Supreme Court justices really being underprotective of the constitutional right to vote. So what it says about a democracy is that the courts are too involved, but what it says when you dive into the cases is that judges are just unwilling to protect the right to vote right now, instead preferring to defer to state election administration.
Is that because of President Trump's success in appointing judges to the federal courts?
Yeah. A large part of it is. So, okay. So if you look at those 17 cases, 8 of them were 2-1 decisions with a Trump-appointed judge at the majority.
Okay.
One of those 17 cases was a 6-4 decision from the 11th Circuit Court of Appeals. This is in the Florida felon disenfranchisement case. So the full appellate court heard it. Out of that 6-4 decision, 5 of the 6 were Trump-appointed judges. So I do think that you're seeing a large effect from Mitch McConnell and President Trump's plan to fill the court with lots of conservative judges that are now having an effect on the elections. Now, that's not to say that these judges are acting overtly partisan, but I think their ideological worldview and jurisprudence leads them to issue these rulings that really defer to the states.
So we have that, which does not bode well for Democrats should this go through the court system at the presidential level. But the New York Times is reporting this morning that at least 9 times since April, the high court has issued rulings in election disputes, but without their unsigned orders. They are without reasoning for the decisions that they made, which sometimes leaves lower courts left to wonder why and how do we handle this if there are further disputes. How unusual is this for the court to issue orders but not give any reasoning behind it?
Well, it's part of what is called the shadow docket of the U.S. Mm-hmm. Supreme Court, because these are emergency stay applications or emergency motions. And so it happens in other cases besides election cases. Death penalty litigation, for example, has to be very fast-tracked and have emergency petitions like this. And it is common for the court to rule quickly without large opinions, just because they don't have the time to do it and the nature of the case. They reserve their opinion writing for their so-called merits docket, where they grant certiorari, the technical term, and then they hold oral argument. Now, they will sometimes write an opinion even in the shadow docket. They did that back in April in the Wisconsin case that involved elections to try to explain their reasoning some more. We may see some opinions coming out of the U.S. Supreme Court this week, even in the North Carolina case that we've been talking about, as well as the Pennsylvania case, which is back in front of the court. And if I might amplify on what Josh was saying about the new appointees and the jurisprudential clash of values between some judges and other judges, I think part of the instability of litigation right now is we are seeing a transformation in fundamental attitude about the U.S. Constitution and its relationship to voting rights and election law, that to really fully understand, you have to go back to the 1960s. I've tried to write a little bit about this for the Washington Post recently, but basically the precedents that the Supreme Court has decided in the last half century were built on one theory of the Constitution. That was a more progressive theory, the likes of Justice Brennan, if some of your listeners have heard of that, some icons of American jurisprudence, Justice Thurgood Marshall and so forth. That jurisprudence has been replaced effectively with the original intent theory of judging that Justice Scalia was famous for, and it's come up in the recent confirmation hearings. An original intent philosophy will take you to a very different place in terms of the role of the courts than the progressive vision of the Warren Court. And we're seeing this shift in jurisprudence playing out this year in real time in all these cases.
And we've seen a shift in the court since the 2000 Bush v. Gore decision by the Supreme Court. I'm just curious, we had butterfly ballot issues, we had hanging chad issues that the courts had to get involved in. Would it be accurate to say that today legal arguments are more complex, particularly when they surround the mail-in voting, things that we've been talking about, because hundreds of lawsuits are swirling around those mail-in ballots, Josh. What might the arguments center around after Election Day this year?
Well, in some ways, the arguments are more complex because we've had several decades of the courts being very involved in election law. I often like to say that preparing for election litigation is just now a routine part of campaign strategy. But on the other hand, the legal arguments are becoming less complex because of this deference that the courts are showing to the state legislatures and state election officials. So I've been exploring these cases and doing some writing, and I've termed this undue deference to state legislatures, where the courts are really just saying to the state legislatures and the election officials, look, we're not going to intervene. So if you want to have your mail-in ballots be a certain rule, that's fine. And, you know, if voters have a harder time because of the pandemic, essentially, that's too bad. Now, in terms of what litigation post November 3rd might look like with respect to mail-in ballots, now, of course, Ned's correct. We worry about what's the margin of litigation. Are the counts close enough? But we do have some potential issues. And I think the biggest one will be for ballots that arrive after November 3rd in the states that purportedly don't allow it. So that's the issue in North Carolina. That's the issue in Pennsylvania. And the Pennsylvania Republicans have asked the U.S. Supreme Court and the Pennsylvania Supreme Court to segregate those ballots that arrive late as the courts decide whether to allow the states to accept those. So if the courts agree to segregate those ballots so we can set them aside, and we know, you know, that we have to have a dispute essentially as to whether they can count if they arrived after November 3rd, well, that could be a major thing that's litigated. The other thing that could be litigated post-election is what are called provisional ballots. These are for in-person voters who show up to vote and there's some sort of problem. They're not on the registration list. They don't have the right kind of ID. And these are the voters allowed to cast a ballot, but it's essentially set aside in a special envelope. And then we figure out after the election whether they should count. And again, if the vote is close enough, those can be litigated.
President Trump has told his voters to watch closely at the polls. And of course, there will be official poll watchers from both parties at the polls. But Republicans had been under a consent decree going back to the 1980s when Democrats accused them of violating the rights of Black and Latino voters. And the court allowed this decree to expire in 2018. When we come back, Ned, I want to hear from you about whether or not this will have any impact in this election cycle. We have to take a break, otherwise I'd let you answer it now. Ned Foley is with us. He's the College of Law Chair at Ohio State University, and Joshua Douglas is here, Professor of Law at the University of Kentucky at Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Fifth Third Bank, dedicated to the financial empowerment of the community by investing time, resources, and people in the Charlotte area and throughout the state. More at 53.com. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about the legal challenges to voting this year and the impact that may play in the outcome of this election as various challenges wind their way through the courts with Ned Foley, the College of Law Chair at the Ohio State Moritz College of Law and author of Ballot Battles, The History of Disputed Elections in the United States, and Joshua Douglas, Professor of Law at the University of Kentucky and author of Vote for Us, How to Take Back Our Elections and Change the Future of Voting. So just prior to the break, I asked you about this decree that a consent decree that was allowed to expire in 2018 that kind of put a little dog collar on Republicans when it comes to being at the polls and watching things. It's expired. So what impact might that have this year?
Well, I hope it doesn't have too much impact. It does raise the concern about voter suppression and voter intimidation, that there may be more aggressive tactics. And we've seen some evidence of that, unfortunately. I think it's useful to distinguish two different perspectives when evaluating the voting process. One is the perspective of the individual voter. I don't want any single voter improperly disenfranchised or to face intimidation or to have their vote suppressed, because we all have an equal right to vote. And so if any one of us suffers a wrong in that respect, it's a wrong that shouldn't happen. And there ought to be a remedy for it, and we should worry about it. On the other hand, the other perspective on voting is, how is the system as a whole working? Is it producing a result, an outcome, identifying a winner that corresponds to the collective choice of the electorate as a whole? And it is possible for the system to work to produce the right answer, if you will, in terms of collective voter choice, even when there are mistakes that happen or bad things that happen that shouldn't happen to individuals. So I think we have to have both perspectives simultaneously. We should try to eliminate all suppression and all intimidation. But if we see some of it, as much as we complain about it, it doesn't undermine necessarily the entirety of the electoral process. And so we have to be able to look at both perspectives at the same time.
Is the only way to avoid these battles, particularly the ones that will follow an election once the polls have closed, is the only way to win decisively with a wide margin? Or in the current political environment, Ned, is even that going to be something that stops suits going forward?
Well, this does worry me. Again, I hope my concern is theoretical and we won't see it in practice, but what worries me is that so much doubt has been cast over the process, including particularly vote by mail, including by the president, that people will distrust the outcome, even if the outcome is valid. I mean, think of the irony or the tragedy if we actually, in the year of the pandemic, produce a result that is authentic to the choice that the voters make. But there's so much doubt about it, we ignore the will of the people. That would defeat the very essence of democracy. How could that happen in practice? Our Constitution is complicated and it's old, and it has a provision in it that allows state legislatures to choose the method of appointing electors. They've chosen to let us as citizens vote for the members of the Electoral College so that we as citizens participate in presidential elections. And I think if the legislature attempted to reassert any of its own power in this regard, it would lead to massive lawsuits and protests. But there is this Achilles heel in our system, if you will, this vulnerability that if state legislatures, whether North Carolina or Pennsylvania and any of these battlegrounds say, you know, we don't trust the outcome, we're going to take matters into our own hands, that could be a real problem. And that wouldn't necessarily depend on whether it's a 500 vote margin or it's a 5,000 vote margin. It depends on just how much distrust there is.
And we expect elections to be political. That's what they're about. And we expect the parties to fight for their candidates at every level. And that's what that's about. But we expect the courts not to be political. But you have said, Josh, that one factor in all these legal battles is the political makeup of the state Supreme Courts. And you point to North Carolina and Pennsylvania, which have Democratic majorities, Wisconsin, which has a Republican majority. Why should that matter? These people are just judges.
Yeah, you would hope it wouldn't matter. And you know, I think this in some ways calls into question electing judges on a partisan basis to begin with. But that's a system that, you know, 39 states have, is electing judges. And of course, appointing judges isn't necessarily the cure for partisanship on the courts. But, you know, that's the whole point of this litigation, is to focus on precedents, to focus on the text of various provisions. But there's enough ambiguity, right? You know, this notion that judges should just be umpires calling balls and strikes masks the very fact of judging as a craft that requires analysis of various texts that don't have clear answers. You know, just like umpires have slightly different strike zones, judges have slightly different ways of thinking about the different legal texts. And unfortunately, we're seeing even greater politicization of the courts, not only on the federal side, but the state side. Now, that said, I think state courts have been better in this election cycle at vindicating the constitutional right to vote. I think that's in part because state constitutions, as a textual matter, go further in protecting the right to vote than the U.S. Constitution does. This case from Pennsylvania, the Pennsylvania Supreme Court, that's up at the U.S. Supreme Court right now, is very concerning to me, because if the U.S. Supreme Court decides to review this case on the merits and basically tell the Pennsylvania Supreme Court that it misinterpreted the Pennsylvania Constitution, well, now you have the U.S. Supreme Court essentially inserting itself in every election law dispute, including those from the state courts, which I think could lead to very narrow protection for the right to vote, not only on the federal level, but the state level as well.
Do you agree with that, Ned? Because you called the Supreme Court ruling in Pennsylvania about moving the deadline to, I think, 3 days after Election Day as more of a reprieve for Democrats than a win. But do you see the same warning signs that Josh does?
Well, I completely agree with Josh that this is a potentially momentous case. And I also agree that it raises very difficult questions of federal constitutional interpretation about what the role of the federal constitution and the federal court is in terms of supervising state government in federal elections like congressional elections or the presidential elections. I think there are tricky arguments on both sides, which is one of the reasons why I'm worried that it might be decided in the compression of just this 1 week between now and Election Day. And I think if the U.S. Supreme Court is smart, they'll look for an exit strategy to try to not do something really momentous in a short time pressure. But they might. Chief Justice Roberts, in a case in Arizona, signaled an interest in this theory called the independent state legislature theory, which, as Josh alluded to, means that as a matter of federal law, the state legislature is in control of the rules. So you can't have other bodies within state government, be it a state court or a state executive agency, that changes the rules that the state legislature adopts for elections. You know, and if that theory were to get five votes on the U.S. Supreme Court, it would be, you know, a big move in American election law. So we could be seeing that coming right now.
Even if these various court decisions are essentially correct, they're bogged down in legal minutiae that the average person has great difficulty understanding. You have to have a legal mind to really understand, to parse it, I suppose, is the better word. And that, it seems to me, causes mistrust in the system. And you wrote, Ned, an article for the Washington Post on how to avoid a second Bush v. Gore, which you called the Supreme Court's intervention. You called that intervention a low moment for the high court, and asserted that the political fallout this time would be even more damaging. And I'm wondering if you think that, at least at the Supreme Court level, they think about things like that when they approach these new decisions, particularly if a new justice joins the court, as she very well may today, and who is a Trump appointee, and Trump takes a case to the Supreme Court to decide this election. Do they think about the impact of their decision on the confidence in of the voter and the citizens in the process?
Oh, I think definitely. I mean, I think they are astute and they understand, at least to some degree, how their opinions relate to public opinion. But they have to worry about two things from their perspective. One is fidelity to the Constitution, right? They're sworn to uphold the Constitution as they see it sincerely from their perspective. And that may lead them to results that, frankly, don't seem very small d democratic, because some features of the U.S. Constitution, unfortunately, are not as small d democratic as Josh and I probably would like them to be in terms of popular sovereignty and the will of the people. So a justice on the court who thinks in terms of original intent says, what's my obligation? Is it to uphold the Constitution as I see it, or is it to make sure that the public doesn't lose confidence in the court as a nonpartisan institution when there are members of my own court who disagree as I do? Josh said it correctly that some of these provisions are very ambiguous and are not self-defining. And when you have judges themselves splitting on what looks like party line votes, where Democratic appointees go one way and Republican appointees go the other way, that shakes our confidence in the court as a nonpartisan institution. So I think the court is in a difficult place with these two competing obligations to society.
Since we're very likely to have a swing to the right on the Supreme Court as of sometime today with the appointment of Amy Coney Barrett as a justice on the Supreme Court, I'm wondering about the impact of original intent on something that may happen in this election. And I'm trying to remember what it was. I've just lost my train of thought. Rats.
Well, as you're thinking about that, let me add something to what Ned just said, which is I think we're going to find out this week whether enough justices do agree that they need to be cognizant of the public support for the court as an institution. Okay. And that's because of the Pennsylvania case. You know, the Pennsylvania Republicans had already requested an emergency ruling from the Supreme Court last week, which tied 4-4 with Chief Justice Roberts joining the other so-called liberals to deny the request from the Pennsylvania Republicans. And we do know that, for example, Justices Thomas and I'd argue probably Justice Alito see themselves more in fidelity to the Constitution and don't really care if their opinions are unpopular. Chief Justice Roberts, I think, cares a lot more about the institutional legitimacy of the court.
Here's
so
what I was...
if Justice Barrett, you know, sides with the other conservatives, then I think we'll know what the majority actually thinks on that question.
Here's what I was going to ask about. Electors, because if you're an originalist and you're trying to interpret the Constitution the way it was written by the Founding Fathers, it's kind of sticky because there's very little in the Constitution about electors and how they work. And there have been conversations this year about some states saying, well, we don't care what the popular vote says. We will tell our electors to vote for candidate A or candidate B. Does that fly in the face of an originalist's interpretation? If that goes to the Supreme Court, if somebody challenges a state for doing that, how might the Supreme Court decide?
Yeah, that's a really tough one. I think we have to think whether the court will decide that or Congress, because the 12th Amendment of the Constitution creates a special joint session of Congress that meets on January 6th to receive the electoral votes from the states. I think if state legislatures do what, Mike, you hypothesize, mm-hmm. we're going to have a huge fight. It's going to look, it won't even look like Bush versus Gore in 2000. It'll be even uglier. It'll look like the Hayes-Tilden dispute back in 1876, which none of us were around for, and we have to dust off the history to understand. Right. What it would mean is there would be rival submissions of electoral votes coming from the battleground states. So in North Carolina, for example, if the legislature said, we don't trust the popular vote, we don't know how to count it, we're going to try to appoint, say, the Trump electors to go to send their votes. I think very likely the Democrats would say, no, we're gonna vote for Biden. Maybe the governor would back that. That could happen in Pennsylvania, Michigan, Wisconsin. So you'll have these rival submissions go to Congress, and Congress would have to figure it out. Big question mark whether the Supreme Court would step in when the dispute is in front of Congress that way.
And some have speculated that the president could ask a court to deem all absentee ballots fraudulent, declare himself the winner, and he would have Attorney General Bill Barr in his corner. Do you see that as a possibility, and is it one that could be successful? Who wants to take
it? I don't think it could be successful. Okay. I it would just be shocking if anything like that was tried by either our president or the Department of Justice. And I think here is where, you know, I do have residual faith in our judicial system to uphold the rule of law. I think if it looked to judges, including federal judges, that our system had run amok to the point where incumbents were trying, in essence, to steal the election to just protect their own incumbency without any justifiable basis for doing so. Because the claim that all vote-by-mail ballots are fraudulent is just preposterous. It's just not based on evidence. And the whole point of an electoral system is that it needs to be fact-based and evidence-based. Every single vote-by-mail ballot has to be verified in order to be counted. That's why there's rejection rates involving absentee votes. That's why we're troubled if rejection rates are too high. But the flip side of that point is that the ballot has to prove its validity. And so anybody who wants to not count an absentee ballot needs to have other evidence to justify why it shouldn't be counted, because it's not going to get counted until or already it proves itself. So the idea that the Department of Justice could, in an across-the-board way, try to disqualify all these ballots just seems untenable to me.
And with that, you get the last word. I was going to ask Joshua if there was any hope for the future of our election system. I guess we'll have to read your book. That book happens to be How to Take Back Our Elections and Change the Future of Voting, called Vote for Us. Joshua Douglas from the University of Kentucky. Ned Foley, the from Ohio State University. Ballot Battles, the History of Disputed Elections in the United States. Thank you both for the hour. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to drivers that share Mazda's passion that cars make driving matter. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.